Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is the Vice Guide to Right Now, your inside look into the best of Vice. It's Friday, April 26th. I'm Sophie Cazis. Today, we're talking about how, with legalization, the wild west of weed is dying out, and we're taking a look at what's replacing it. Across the U.S., somewhere between 200,000 and 250,000 people were estimated to be working in the $10.4 billion legal cannabis industry in 2018. It's projected that by 2021, one cannabis job will exist for every 1,000 people in the U.S. That's roughly 325,700 jobs nationwide. While it's clear that the growing legal cannabis industry is yielding winners and losers, it's also true that legal weed has made it possible for some people to switch from being employed by quasi-legal or criminal enterprises to above-board businesses. So on this episode, I sat down with reporter Danielle Simone Brand to learn more about the new career paths being forged by cannabis legalization. Hey, Danielle, how are you?
Hey, Sophie. I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm good. So, as you know, it's Weed Week here at Vice, and we're doing a lot of different kinds of cannabis coverage. And you wrote about the different opportunities and markets that are opening up with legalization. And specifically, you focused on the opportunities that people who were formerly working in the unregulated market are taking advantage of as they move into the legal cannabis industry. So to start us off, what are some of the types of opportunities you see as prohibition is fading away?
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, there have always been entrepreneurs in the cannabis industry, of course. You know, there were growers and makers of all kinds of products and sellers, just like there are today. But before, they didn't have access to the capital through normal channels, of course. And so now I'm seeing that cannabis entrepreneurs are really able to raise money, and in some cases, a lot of it, and make their products, open stores, start their growing operations. So I think entrepreneurship is one category that's really growing at this point. There's also quite a bit of opportunity in the retail side of things, bud tending, you know, that's working at a legal dispensary, selling and recommending products to customers. That's a job that's, you know, sort of new. That's also pretty open to entry. That's a significant opportunity for people who want to get started in the cannabis industry. I often find that people who have worked in hospitality or serving, you know, in restaurants, they tend to gravitate toward bud tending jobs if they want to get started in cannabis. And really, you know, in some ways in the legal states, it's not really that different from working at a grocery store, let's say. And then I would also say last that there's a whole adjacent to cannabis industry that's growing up around, you know, around cannabis. And that's not people who are working directly with the plant necessarily, but, you know, doctors, lawyers, IT people, people who are working on, you know, all kinds of new software solutions. There's real estate agents and accountants and journalists like me or another, you know, growing field, growing opportunity in this field.
Absolutely. And I think it's clear that there are a lot of new jobs and opportunities opening up as the cannabis industry legalizes. But I think the elephant in the room with this conversation about who's benefiting from legalization is that we know that the industry, the legal industry, is overwhelmingly run by white entrepreneurs. And at the same time, Black and brown communities continue to make up the vast majority of weed-related arrests. And, you know, there are all sorts of stats about 1% of dispensaries in the U.S. are Black-owned. While there are similar rates of weed use among Black and white people, it's Black and Latino people who represent half of drug violations. So I'm curious, you know, knowing all of this context, how you kind of navigated and wove that into your piece about who and what's being gained by moving into the legal market.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I'm really fortunate to have a wide network of people that I know who work with and around weed. And I feel like social media is a great place. It's, you know, it's an equalizer in some ways. And it's a great place to meet people who you may not have the opportunity to meet in everyday life who are doing amazing things. And so I've been able to meet a number of people of color, you know, online who are working in cannabis, who are either transitioning from the black market to the regulated side, or who are just getting started in cannabis now. And I really wanted to bring those voices into this piece because, as you said, people of color have been disproportionately affected by the war on drugs. And I really hope that more social equity comes into the cannabis industry as we go forward. So it was important to me to really seek out some of those other voices.
Yeah. And I'm just curious about people who have cannabis-related convictions and how that affects people trying to take advantage of the legal industry. I think you talked about that briefly in your piece, at least what's happening around that in California.
Yeah, I think that it depends a lot by state and also by city. But in the city of LA, for instance, there is a social equity program in place. It certainly has flaws. People have criticized it. It's not perfect, but it does represent, you know, some effort on the part of planners to include people of color, low-income people, and those who have had previous cannabis convictions as well, and to give them some degree of priority in the licensing process for who gets, you know, a cannabis license. These are obviously, you know, limited licenses. And I know that's not the case in every state or city where adult use is legal. In fact, it's probably not the case in the majority of places right now, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But I think LA is, you know, is trying to lead the way when it comes to that issue.
So let's get back to the core of your story. What are some of the strategies that people you talk to are using to go from working in the gray or black markets to kind of moving above board with their cannabis-related work?
Yeah, I think there are some different ways. You know, I noticed that there are vast networks that people describe that were already in place, basically, for people who worked in weed in the unregulated market. And so in some cases, I think people are starting to move really along with their networks, along with their associates and their friends into the legal side of things. And that's what I observed at Flocana, for instance, in Northern California, in Mendocino. Now, for jobs like bud tending, I think it's pretty easy in cities with big markets to just get a job, you know, get started that way, to walk in and say, I have some experience as a server, for instance. And that's an entry point for a lot of new people. And then the third sort of area that I'm seeing people enter is through study. So there are a number of new cannabis studies programs at a handful of U.S. colleges and universities. And there are also some trade schools like Oaksterdam, that's in Oakland, California. And then, of course, the entrepreneurship route, I guess I would add a fourth. There are people just out there on their own, you know, working to make a product, raise some capital, get investors, and, you know, start selling. So, you know, those four areas, I think, are the most common right now.
Yeah. Can you talk more about Flocana? You spoke to a woman named Ashley who works there currently. What's her story and what is Flocana?
Yeah. Flocana is a clearinghouse for small pot farms in Northern California. So they will buy the harvest from various small farmers and then process it, make it something that's saleable for the market and distribute it all throughout California. So it helps small farmers basically do what they love to do, which is cultivate cannabis. And it takes care of some of that, you know, processing and distribution and business side of things. So that's what Flocana is. And I talked to a woman there named Alicia Ashley. I also spoke to one of her coworkers, and her story didn't make it into the piece. But Alicia works as a processor on the floor of the Flocana factory. She basically runs a labeling machine. She puts labels on jars of flower. She, you know, makes sure that the quality is good. She rolls joints by hand. And that's, you know, a fully legit job with paid time off and benefits. And that's something that, you know, I think people who have worked with cannabis for a long time in the unregulated side are looking for at this point, a more stable job, a more reliable income, and, you know, a way to really grow in the industry.
How is that working out for her? Is she making more money? Is she making the same amount of money? Is it just that the sort of safety and security that comes with working, you know, on the legal side of things is very reassuring to her? Sort of, what's her take on it?
Well, she was incredibly enthusiastic about her current job at Flokana and also about her prospects in the future of cannabis. She probably makes less money. That was my sense, that she makes a bit less money now because, you know, under the table cash is always, you know, an easier way to make an income in a certain sense. But she receives health benefits. She gets paid time off, like I mentioned. She gets, you know, things that go along with a traditional full-time job, or at least that are supposed to go along with that now. And I think she appreciates it quite a lot. And Alicia also has a daughter. And so it feels like a more conventional life path in a certain way, and a good career choice for her. And one more thing I wanted to add actually about her story is that she feels really hopeful that she can continue to grow. You know, she's working on the factory floor right now, but she's also going to business school and would like to, you know, work as a farm liaison or a supervisor. And that's something she feels she has now. It's career mobility, upward mobility. And that's something that she probably didn't have quite as much when working in the unregulated side of the market.
In your piece, you talked a little bit about how in the underground or unregulated cannabis market, sexual harassment can be a big issue for women. Can you talk a little bit about what you learned through your research on how legalization is affecting that?
Sure. I did hear about that for sure. One woman that I interviewed who worked in similar situations to Ashley prior to legalization did in fact suffer harassment and fears for her personal safety at times while she was working up on the Hill. It's certainly described as a male-dominated culture in any case. But there were others that I interviewed, like Ashley herself and like one of her coworkers, who said that she had to keep her wits about her. She also had to really know who she was working for and not just randomly accept a job, for instance, and that she used her head to keep herself safe. And she didn't really say that the job in the black market was without risks, but she said she didn't suffer many of the things that other women have. In part, she said she was fortunate. Mm. And I did hear that from a few people. I was fortunate not to be sexually harassed. And that's, you know, not something that should really go along with a regular job. I should add also that everybody that I interviewed who worked at some point, you know, as a trimmer, for instance, or in the unregulated market, said that it was a community, that we looked out for each other, and that, you know, of course, there are always bad apples, so to speak. There are people who you can't trust. But for the most part, they said that, you know, we felt like we could trust the people we worked with.
You also spoke to a woman named Jennifer Mehta. Can you tell us about her journey in the cannabis industry?
Yeah, Jennifer Mehta is a really interesting person. She is a Southerner full of, you know, interesting things to say, great turns of phrase. She's also the daughter of two immigrants. Her mother came from Ireland and her father came from Gujarat, India. And she described herself as someone who looked like the people who were hated by many Americans during the 9/11 experience. So she had an interesting journey coming up through the South and in the illegal weed industry at the time. She's 47 years old now, and she's been involved in cannabis in every capacity, it seems, for about 30 years. She trimmed, she grew, she cloned, she sold products to various markets, and she also infused her own edibles. She also came up through the black market, like I said, and then the gray market, that kind of transitional phase where medical marijuana was legal in certain places like Oregon. That's where she was working at the time. And it was a Wild West then. That's how she described it. A Wild West where anyone who had a medical card could actually grow and sell to a dispensary. And cannabis entrepreneurship was just blowing up at the time. And now she's a cannabis entrepreneur in her own right. And she owns two hemp companies that are working solely on the legal side. So, you know, her journey has been really, really interesting from the old days to the kind of transition days to, you know, to what's going on now.
One thing that Jennifer Mehta spoke about was some of the challenges that being a woman of color in the industry has posed. And specifically, she talked about how it was occasionally hard to sell her product to dispensaries. Can you talk about her experience with that and what she said?
Yeah. So there were times that Jennifer Mehta described having a pretty smooth transaction when she was trying to sell her product at dispensaries in North Carolina, where she lives now. And there were other times when she was not able to sell her product, even though she has so much expertise and experience in the field. And she decided to kind of experiment with that a little bit and send in a white man who is one of her partners in business to the dispensaries and see if the transaction went any more smoothly. And it did. So, you know, she does surmise that her skin color and maybe gender as well has something to do with some resistance to working with her from people in the cannabis industry, at least where she lives right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she had a lot of really telling stories and interesting things to say. Another thing that she talked about was kind of these major infrastructure challenges about being on the legal side of things, banking, shipping, getting insurance is super hard, and how all of that kind of affects smaller cannabis workers trying to come out of the shadows. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, she did talk about that quite a bit. And, you know, it makes it a lot harder to do business, of course, when it's tough to get insurance or you can't get it at all, when cannabis business owners can't open a bank account, like the kind that they actually need to do business smoothly. Her shipments, she said, are subject to search and confiscation. And all those obstacles are very real. But at the same time, people that I talked to, including Amanda Ryman, who works at Flokana, who's a VP of community relations there, she said, in a certain way, some people are almost appreciative of federal prohibition at this point. I know that sounds strange, but because it prevents, in a way, it prevents big multinational corporations from sinking their teeth fully into cannabis yet. Because as soon as it's easy to ship products across state lines, as soon as banking restrictions and shipping restrictions are lifted, big business is going to jump in with both feet. And so, you know, maybe this kind of transition or half-half stage is making it a bit easier, or at least possible, for these smaller businesses to get a foothold first.
Yeah, that's super interesting. My last question is just, you know, what you would want your readers and our listeners to take away from this piece.
What I learned from writing this piece and interviewing a lot of people who are working in cannabis right now is that there is an abundance of talented and passionate people who are working in legal weed and want to work in legal weed. And many of them bring their know-how from working in the industry years past, you know, really working on the sidelines and in the shadows of the industry that's now coming into its fruition. Another thing that I learned is that, and I knew this already, federal prohibition will likely end at some point in the near future. And while that's a really good thing overall, I think it's a great opportunity right now, like I was just saying, for small businesses to establish themselves before multinational corps just really jump in. And then I had one more takeaway from writing this, and that Amanda Ryman said this, and I'm going to paraphrase her, but basically she said that this industry has a unique opportunity. In a way, we're starting from the ground up. We as in, you know, those who work in and adjacent to the industry. And we can work in a way that prioritizes social and environmental well-being and to really set those standards for the future of the cannabis industry. And I really want that for the industry. And I think many of the people I interviewed want that too.
I think that's a great place to end. Thank you so much, Danielle.
You're welcome, Sophie. Thank you so much. A pleasure.
You can read the full story at vice.com. That's it for now. Thanks so much for listening. And make sure to tune in again on Monday for another Vice Guide to Right Now.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt, so throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.